My name's Fiona. I'm an author and a psychologist. I've spent most of my career speaking to people in depth about their lives, trying to work out what makes them tick. I absolutely love hearing about people's upbringings, backgrounds. Everyone is unique and fascinating. And now I'm so excited to be able to share some of these amazing stories with you. So today I'm thrilled to be joined by Joy Foster, who I met, it sounds very fancy, who I met at the Houses of Parliament. it's not quite as fancy as it sounds, is it? But it was a good event that we were at that time.
It was fancy. And in fact, that was a huge day for me because I met one of my big investors that day. Oh. And I was not coming into that event with that expectation, you know, but that's the power of someone, namely Sarah Lloyd Hughes, being amazing. That's the power of someone kind of saying at an event, what kind of person are you looking forward to sitting next to? I've never had anyone ask that. And I'm really glad that when I put on there, you know, I was looking for someone to potentially invest in my company, and voila, she ended up sitting next to me. It was amazing.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. I know that someone I know ended up becoming involved. I don't know if that's related to that. My old boss sat on your table.
Oh, really?
Amy Chappell.
Yeah, well, that would be the investor that came in on the business.
She's an amazing lady.
What a small world. No, she's incredible. I'm so lucky to have a woman like her. But also, you know, the thing is when we were in that room, Sarah Lloyd Hughes had arranged all of these amazing speakers. And one of the speakers, she's really heavily involved in, I think, Unilever, like she's a big name in Unilever. And anyway, I just remember she said, I wish someone had given me this advice earlier in life. And, you know, and that advice is jump and the net will be there. And I was going into that day thinking, do I raise investment? Do I not raise investment? I was thinking about it. I was pretty sure I wanted to raise investment, but I was still having a bit of a wobble on it because it was such a big deal. Like, I didn't know if anyone was going to invest in my company. I didn't know if anyone was going to, you know, you just don't know. And you don't know until you put it out there. And then, you know, the worst thing you could do is put it out there and then no one wants to give you money and no one wants to help you. And I think so often in our minds, we go to the worst case scenario. So often in our minds, we think, well, no one's going to support this, or what if no one supports this? And we don't actually do the flip side and think, well, what if I had to turn down money, which actually was the case in my case when we did raise investment. I actually had to turn people down. That's we had brilliant. More money come in. But, you know, it's one of those things where that day was so pivotal for me. Meeting you was amazing. Getting to hear about your book. But I think just someone standing up on stage who'd made it saying, you know, jump and the net will be there. I needed to hear that day. And I think that really set the tone for the conversations that I had with other people like Amy. And, you know, and it just opened up the door for my brain to think, well, if I jump, what's going to happen? And so, yeah, I feel really lucky that I had that moment. I got to meet her at another private dinner. And I'm blanking on her name, but I got to meet her at another private dinner that Sarah held. And I literally walked up to her. I was so nervous to do it, but I like told her that, you know, what she said really impacted me. And I was like crying and, you know, I couldn't compose myself. And, you know, and I think it touched her. I think, you know, anytime someone can circle back to you and say, you know, what you said to me had a huge impact. It really does mean a lot. And I, you know, I'm lucky that I got to actually go back to her and tell her what an impact that had on me.
I do think that's amazing. And I can see the image of that lady in my head because I spoke to her as well. And I can't remember her name. But yes, it's great. It's amazing to be able to give that feedback because I think often people don't realize. I mean, my next book's about role models, and often people are role models to other people without realizing. And I was speaking to an athlete, an Olympian recently, who said as soon as he won his gold, he told his karate teacher, and karate wasn't his specialty that he won the gold in, but he told his karate teacher because it was a karate teacher when he was a kid that inspired him. And his karate teacher was like, wow, you know, he'd had no idea. And then since then, Dina Asher Smith's mum has approached this particular guy I was talking to and said, you know, you've been an inspiration for Dina Asher Smith. But but people often don't realise the impact they're having, positive impact they're having on the people around them. And the negative, yes, too, but the positive. And if you can share that, it's really powerful, not just for you, but for that other person. And then it helps them to feel confident to replicate that, I think, as well, for more people. So it's sort of like it passes on the good, as it were.
No, I think that's our responsibility, you know, and I tell that story a lot. I always say, you know, I didn't believe, I was, you know, when I was trying to make a decision, I wasn't sure. Someone gave me that phrase, you know, jump and the net will be there. And I say, you know, it was true for me and it was true for her. And I think, you know, and I think one of the things I've really learned, in this incredible journey that is Tech Pixies, that was, you know, literally an idea to help 12 women return to work in Oxfordshire, funded by the Oxfordshire County Council and the Government Equalities Office. I mean, I literally earlier today was speaking to the guy who I called up and I said, literally, I have this idea. I want to bring a digital skills school to Oxford. And he's like, oh, Joy, you're never going to believe it. This grant came across my desk. You should apply. And, you know, the key piece of that story is not that there was a grant that came across his desk. The key part of that story was I picked up the phone and called someone who I knew in my community would be able to point me in the right direction to get an idea I had off the ground. And, you know, it goes as far back as that. And I just said to him today, you know, because we were planning on doing something really cool to help the local community in this coronavirus environment. And I said to him today, I mean, I hope you know that you are, like, still in my mind, one of the very first most important people in Tech Pixies, because when I called you and asked for advice, you pointed me in the right direction and we got the funding to start. And I just think, you know, those little interactions and, you know, even if you can't remember people's names, and obviously I remember his name, but even if you can't remember people's names, you know, the way people make you feel and the things that they say to you are those things that will impact you, you know. And if you read Becoming, I mean, I love Becoming. I really love that book. But she talks about the college counselor who said, you know, who discouraged her, you know, and she used that as fuel.
And then there's just when you were talking just then, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but there's that Maya Angelou quote, which is one of my very favorite, Paul, and I'll get it wrong, but people will forget what you say. They'll forget who you are, but they'll never forget how you make them feel.
Yeah. Giving chills because it's so true.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. And I think it's really important actually to have the confidence if you don't remember someone's name, because I'm awful with names, but the feeling that someone gives you and the connection you have with them shouldn't be undermined by not remembering their name. So if we rewind, because Tech Pixies, as I've said to you, I think is amazing. And I really want to talk about that a bit more. But if we go right back, you're from the US. You're not from Oxfordshire.
How could you tell?
How could I tell? I think you told me. I wouldn't have known otherwise. So where did you grow up and what was growing up like for you?
Yeah, well, so I always say guys and gals and people are like, what is a gal? A gal is a woman, and I grew up in Colorado, and I'm a Colorado gal. And so I was born and raised in Colorado. I was born in Denver, raised in Castle Rock, which is just south of Denver. And I lived there till I was about 15. And then I got an opportunity to be a Rotary exchange student, and I went to France. I applied when I was 13 and didn't tell my parents that I was applying. Yeah. And that's probably like set the tone for my life, actually. But I applied for this international exchange student program.
And you didn't tell your parents. I love it.
Yeah. And actually I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, why did I do that? And there was an exchange student that used to ride the bus with us. He was Swedish and he was really cute and really nice. And I guess I thought, you know, well, if there's cute, nice guys like abroad, I'll go do it, which is funny because I did end up marrying a cute, nice guy from abroad. But that was probably always going to be my destiny. But anyway, I applied for this program. I got in and I wanted to go to Argentina and Venezuela. And no surprise, the cute exchange student on our bus was from one of those countries. And my parents were like, absolutely not. You know, you're going to go to France, because my mom's lifelong dream was to go to France. And I didn't speak French. I spoke Spanish. And so I thought, well, if she, you know, if that's the only way I get to go, I'll do it. And so I went to France, loved France, learned French, My parents came over. I didn't see them for 8 months. They came over to visit me.
And you were 13 at the time?
I was 13 when I applied. And then by the time you processed and everything, I was 15.
Okay.
That was a pivotal year for me for so many reasons. One, first time I'd ever lived outside of the United States. I'd been outside of the United States a few times, but never lived outside of the United States. I was fully submerged in another language, another culture. If anyone spent any time in France, you know, just like the Americans, the French think that they're, you know, the best country in the world. And so I came back a little bit brainwashed by the French. But, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, American culture is very faith-based. A lot of Americans will consider themselves to be Christian. And I'd never in my life, I didn't even know that there were other religions. And I know that sounds really weird to a lot of people, but there's something, some percentage of Americans who have passports, it's less than 10%. And so when you are brought up in a culture where everyone is the same faith, you just don't even realize there's other faiths. I mean, I knew there were other versions of Christianity. You know, I knew there was Mormonism and I knew there was Judaism. And, you know, those are different time periods of Christianity and, you know, precursors and, you know, whatever. But for me, I didn't understand like Hinduism, Buddhism, Muslim. I just didn't understand Islam. I didn't understand any of that. And so going to France was like totally eye-opening because I was suddenly surrounded by, you know, Kurdish refugees and, you know, just, it was right during the, when Kurdish, you know, the Kurdistan, everything happened there. So we had all of these refugees coming into France. And anyway, I lived with a Fahous family that was incredibly giving. They ran a children's school for children who had severe learning disabilities and severe functional disabilities. And they also ran in a home for adults that did the same, you know, same issues. And they weren't Christian and they were just humanitarians. And for me, I was just like mind blown, like that you could be, you know, a good person and not be a Christian, or you could have an impact in the world and not be a Christian. Cause I only saw the world through one lens. So it definitely questioned my faith. I definitely led me on a path of where I kind of gave up my faith for a couple of years, you know, that was huge for me, because I think if you come back full circle to where I am now, my faith is 100% still the rock of what I make every decision on. But I had to go through a period of kind of walking in the wilderness, if you will. And that started in France. So I came back from France and went back to my high school in the middle of Colorado in a town of 12,000 people. And I lasted about 2 days before I said to my dad, like, I just can't do this. I can't be here. This is like, I've just lived in the other part of the world. I can't do this. And so very fortunately for me, my dad listened to me and he said, well, what do you want to do? And I was very lucky. I got into the number one school in America, which is a boarding school in New Hampshire called Phillips Exeter Academy. And so I got in, which is rare. They only take like 10 senior transfers and they've got over 1,000 students and hundreds of applications. Wow. And so.
Why that school? Why was it? You know, you came back, yeah, and you'd had a life-changing experience. So I can understand why you kind of went back to life as it was and thought, hang on a minute, no, thank you. But how did you come upon choosing that school?
Well, this is also a really good indicator of my character. So I have this thing, or I always had this thing, and I probably still do to a certain extent, that I wanted to be the best in the world at something. Like that was my driving, like from a very young age, I used to tell my dad, you know, I want to be the best in the world at something. I didn't know what that something was, but I just wanted to be the best.
Why do you think? I mean, do you know why you felt like that?
No, but I will say one thing. You know, I never had anyone who discouraged me in my life. Like I think what we see, you know, when someone gets into their 30s and 40s and 50s, and you look at how successful they are in their life, if you have a conversation with them, if someone perceives themselves as not being successful, it will very often tie back to the way they were brought up and what people around them said, teachers, adults, whatever. And, you know, for me, from the day I was born, I mean, I don't remember anything differently. My dad used to say, you know, you're going to be someone special someday. Like my whole life, he said that. Now, I don't know if he had a, if he, you know, if that was just his thing and like his way of encouraging me, but, you know, he always said that. And I would do something and he'd go, you know, I've always known you were going to do something special someday. And, you know, the other thing he used to say to me as I was walking out the door, I mean, so it's also important to know my family, for better or for worse, and we're not Trump fans, but we are come from a long line of Republican fans. And Jack Kemp, who ran for vice president in the 80s with Bob Dole, and they didn't win, but I think he lost to Clinton, actually. He was a big influencer in my life. He was my godfather, for all intents and purposes. And so my dad used to say, as I was walking out the door every day, you know, be a leader, be a leader, be a leader. So I had number one, I had, you know, someone saying, I think you're going to do something special one day. And I had none. And then I also had someone saying, you know, be a leader. And it wasn't just my dad. It was my mom as well.
It's also really interesting because that's not just someone. That is someone who's in a world leading position. So your benchmark right from the start is you've got love and encouragement from your dad. You've been instilled with the belief that you can be. But there's also what you're saying. And if I go back to role models, I'm obsessed with role models at the moment. But your role model and what you're seeing as a benchmark of reality is far beyond what 99.99999% of the population ever even come up against.
Yes, that's true. And I probably didn't recognize that at the time. You know, one of my dad's best friends was Bill McCartney, who led the Million Men March on Washington, D.C. My dad turned down a job in Washington, D.C., working for, you know, with Jack Kemp. He turned it down because he wanted to be with his family. But also, you know, my daughter's godmother is, you know, a prominent family in the U.S. that owns one of the American football teams. So you're right. I grew up in this environment of people who, you know, I was surrounded by people who were really uber successful. And I think this trickles down, you know, people who are uber successful, you know, they don't live in a world of limitations. They live in a world of expectations, you know, and they live in a world of, you know, if you want to do it, you can do it, you know. And I love, I always talk about Henry Ford's quote, which I wish there was a woman's quote that was similar, but, you know, at the time they didn't, women's voices have been so quiet for so long, mm-hmm. because we haven't had a platform until now, that all of these great quotes about business and great quotes about, you know, whatever you want to do in life, they all come from men. And because there's a whole time period which women's voices weren't recorded. But Henry Ford has a great quote, and it is that if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. And yeah. It took me it took me a decade to understand that if your brain, fundamentally, if your brain doesn't think it can do it, it will not be able to do it. Your brain has to think it's a possibility. So, you know, you're right. If I grew up in a household where, you know, my godfather is running for vice president of the United States and, you know, my dad's best friend runs a million person march on Washington, D.C., you just think that's the norm. Mm-hmm. And that is literally the life I lived in. And so when I, you know, when I came back from France and I just, you know, was like, this isn't going to work for me. You know, I think the thing with the school was, this taps back into that original question, that I wanted to be the best at whatever I could be. When my dad kind of said, okay, you know, Joy, I get it. You don't want to stay here. Where do you want to go? And that's what I love about, you know, my parents. They were always kind of, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Who do you want to be? And that was always also very hard for me too, because I didn't know. Partly because now that I know what I'm doing, my job didn't exist when I was that age. Like, I couldn't have foreseen that I would be doing what I'm doing now. It was an impossibility. It didn't exist. But he said is, what do you want to do? And so what I did was I went and researched and I said, okay, I want to go to the number one school in America. You know, if I'm going to stay in America, I'm going to go to the number one school in America. And that's where I found Exeter. And I actually applied to the number one and the number two, and I got into both. And ironically, like, I applied to the number three and four, and I didn't get into the number four school.
Oh, really?
And I remember writing them a letter back saying, you know, oh, I'm not too disappointed I didn't get into your school because I got into these other two. And you know, in the end, that was another life-changing experience. I made some incredible friendships that have lasted my whole life, and I'm sure will come in very handy later on in my life. You know, just people who lived in environments that I lived in. And, you know, and I think it's easy for someone to be listening to this right now and think, oh, you know, she's so privileged and she's, you know, I didn't get that. And I think I want to say, I hear you. I want to say, I don't know what it's like to not be grown up in that environment, but I do know that what happens from this point forwards is based on what you decide to do with the knowledge and information you have and the way that your brain works. And what I mean by that is, if you didn't have the environment that I had, which most people, as you've just said, Fiona, 99% of people don't, and I didn't even realize how privileged and lucky I was when I was growing up to have that environment. If you didn't have that environment, it doesn't matter, because from this moment forward, you can make decisions that have a growth mindset. You can make decisions that open up the possibility of the things that you can do. And you can surround yourself by people who encourage you and build you up. And if you start to just pay attention to how people speak to you, that's a key point. Because what we find at Tech Pixies is a lot of women will come in with that baggage of people who've been cutting them down and keeping them back. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things they realize is they've got to shed a lot of those friends. Yep. You know, they got to let go of those friends. They got to let go of those people. And they've got to really surround themselves. You know, someone once said, you are the sum of the five people you surround yourself with. You've got to surround yourself with positivity. You've got to surround yourself with people who believe you can do things. And you've got to start vision casting. You've got to start tapping into that future you and start to say, you know, what does that future me look like? And what does she want me to do now so that I can become her?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely spot on. And I think it is hard. It is hard because some people will grow up in an environment where they've been put down. They have, they believe in the self-limiting talk that has been given to them. It's much harder to then pivot. However, if you're still surrounded by people who are negative and bringing you down, it becomes almost impossible to get ahead, to move away. But if you surround yourself with people who are positive, it makes massive difference. There's one piece of research I've written in my next book. This isn't actually a plug for my next book, but it sounds like it is. It's about obesity. And there's a huge, and I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but there's this massive study that was done in the US over a long number of years where they looked at people's level of obesity. And if a close friend to you puts on weight, you put on weight. And it's something that is over 100% chance of happening. And the closer that friend is, not in proximity to you, but in terms of your relationship, the more weight you put on, according to how much weight they put on. And okay, that's weight, it's obesity, but it's exactly the same with behavior, with emotion. And that is what I talk about in the book, because it's, we're all role models for one another, and we all feed off one another the whole time, whether we're conscious of it or not. And actually, most of the time, we're not conscious of it, which is why it's so important to choose those people carefully. And then you can forget about it and just get on with what you need to. But they're influencing, everyone's influencing us all the time.
Yeah, well, and this, excuse me, this like comes down even as granular as the social media accounts you follow. So there's two things here. One is you have to understand the neuroscience, right? So I've done a lot of work the last couple months on understanding the neuroscience behind why we think the way we think, why we do what we do. And what we know from neuroscience is that the more we repeat a thought or a belief in our mind, the deeper it grooves in our brain. And that the deeper that goes, the more we believe it. And then, you know, suddenly, you know, we really believe it. And it's very hard to come out of that because the grooves are so deep. And literally, you can look at brain maps and you can see this happening.
Yeah, and that, I think of it as actually a trickle of water. So if you imagine a trickle of water going down one path, the more it goes down that path, the deeper the groove gets and the harder it is to get out of it. And then you have another trickle of water that you're trying to encourage it to the water to branch that way, but it has to go down that way so many times before it's going to branch off.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the best way of describing it. And the thing is you'll never be able to like shut off the other path. I think that's the thing. It's not like you can erase that path. There's no way you can erase that path. But what you can do is make the other one deeper. And the only way you can make the other one deeper is by, you know, repeating affirmations, by believing those affirmations. So you have to find proof in your past that says, you know, like, for example, we deal with a lot of limiting beliefs at Tech Pixies, and a really easy limiting belief that a lot of people have is I'm not worthy. And they don't really realize they've got it until they say it out loud. And then they go, oh, yeah, that resonates with me. Or, you know, I don't deserve this. I mean, I think a big one for me was like, you know, I'm Christian. Profit is a bad thing. I don't deserve to have a successful company that makes money, you know, and profit is bad, you know. And I had to, and if I'm being really honest, you know, I've gone to church almost every Sunday of my life, and I read the Bible almost every day of my life, and I pray almost every. So, you know, wherever that message came into my brain, it was then pulled in deeper and deeper and deeper. And I got to a place where for, you know, a very long time, I believed that it was bad to make a profit. And I believed that it was, that it was bad to prosper. And you know what, if you really dig deep, the Proverbs 31 woman, you know, she's like the woman in the Christian faith that's kind of held up as the woman, you know, that we all aspire to be, you know, she worked and she made money and she, you know, she turned a profit. And it took me, and this is where you have to find proof that you should, you know, you have to find proof that what you think is not true. And, you know, the work that I've been doing with this neuroscience course that I've been taking, you know, really what she teaches is that you figure out what the limiting belief is. So something like, I don't deserve to make money. And then that's called recognizing it. And then what you do is refute it. So you basically like say to the person that you love the most, like your son or your daughter or your husband, you know, you don't deserve to make money. Now you don't actually say it to them, but you have to go through that process of saying to, you know, your son, you know, Asher, you don't deserve to make money. Which I would never say to him because obviously he's got to make money one day because he's got to pay for himself. He can't live with us forever. But you know, you're not worthy. You know, you would never say, I would never say to you, Fiona, you're not worthy. Like I would never ever 100%, but I would say it to myself, but I wouldn't say it to someone else. And so then the third part of this is to actually find evidence that you are worthy, that you do deserve to make money. And, you know, and that's the part where you have to go. And you can't, the thing is not a normal person, but the average person will, or just anyone who's trying to fix this, they will say to themselves, well, I deserve to make money, but they don't believe it, right? They don't believe it because it's so deeply ingrained. So what you have to do is you have to go back and you have to find evidence in your life. So, you know, that's where you would say, actually, I deserve to make money because I work freaking hard. You know, I have been working 60-hour weeks. I have helped thousands of women. You know, I deserve to make money doing that. Like, you know, and my husband has had to spend time with my children because I can't spend time with my children because I'm building this business. And he deserves, you know, to have the house have nice, you know, things in it. And, you know, but it's, you've got to ground it back in something. So the worthiness, you know, I am worthy because of XYZ. And you have to find stuff that really makes you yourself believe it. And then the fourth piece is just to constantly repeat that. So one of the things that I started doing about 3 months ago, and holy cow, has it just impacted my life massively, is that I have a morning routine. I read the book, The Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod. And I got a routine. And actually it happened right when COVID happened, because I was like, well, now we don't have school run. So I'm not going to, you know, I got a little bit more flexibility in the mornings. And actually it turns out with The Miracle Morning, you're just getting up an hour earlier than everybody else in your house anyway. And, but you know, I wake up in the morning, I have a brain priming exercise that I listen to, and it says all those things. It says things like you are worthy and you have a gift to give to the world and you have a voice, that needs to be heard. And, you know, you are one with God and, you know, what you focus on grows. And I mean, I listen to that every morning and then I look at my vision and I have a 3-year vision and it came to me. You know, when I've been doing this brain priming for like 20 days or so, and right before I had a really kind of right in the middle of the coronavirus, we opened up our course. I was scared to death. I thought no one would sign up. You know, I was almost like cut my prices in half because I was, you know, I wanted to make sure everyone could take it and all of this stuff. And I freaked out. And anyway, that particular weekend, I I kind of said to myself, you know, what is this all about? Like, why am I, you know, what am I freaking out about? And it was a real challenge on what I believed the value of our course to be, even despite circumstances. And at the end of the day, I, you know, reconciled with myself to not lower the prices, to not give away my hard work for free, to, you know, and also I think what I've learned too, and this is a realization that I've really come to recently, you know, when you put a high price on something, you're not excluding people who can't pay. People will figure out how to pay for things that they really want to do, right? What you're doing is you're inviting the people who really want to go for it to really invest in you, because you're going to give them your everything. And I think for me with Tech Pixies, you know, we raised the price, I mean, massively. Like when we first went online, I think it was like 180 pounds, pretty much the same program we now sell for 2000. So those lucky gals who got in early, you all know what a gal is now.
Tell us a bit more about Tech Pixie. I mean, for people that have not heard of you, not heard of Tech Pixie, tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, so Tech Pixies is all about upskilling women, helping them to return to work, change careers, or start a business. And we have an 11-week transformational program that's live. And we have three coaches, two social media coaches, a life coach, myself, that walk you through the whole program. It's a very interactive experience. It's an incredibly transformational time for a lot of women. And we've been running it now for 5 years, but we used to run it face-to-face only. And then 2 years ago, it moved online. And I had like a major fail when I moved it online. All sorts of things went wrong. But you know, one of the mistakes we made was I put it out at too low a price. That was really, the value of the course was much higher, but I didn't understand that myself personally. And I also didn't, I was afraid. I was afraid to raise the prices because I thought if I raise the prices, people won't be able to do it. And so we raised the prices from 180 to 360. And then we raised them to 585. And then we raised them to 750. And every time I did it, like my body cringed. And every time I couldn't run the business. I mean, every time I ran the numbers, I was like, I can't even fund my team. You know, yep. Like I'm losing money hand over fist because I'm not willing to raise the prices. So I got into a mastermind, and the mastermind was amazing. It was transformational for me because the people in that group had been running online courses for a long time. And they, when they evaluated my course, they were like, holy cow, Joy, this is worth way more than you're charging.
So you say the mastermind, what is that? Is it a group of people? Is it, how do you find something like that for people that want to, they've got a business and they want to do the similar thing? How do they find it?
Yeah, well, that is a great question. So I think the first thing you need to know is that for any business you want to build out there, there will be someone who's done it before you. And very likely they will be running a course on how to do that, right? So for me, it was, I wanted to become a course creator, an online course creator. So I went and I researched, this goes right back to that original conversation we were having, like where I wanted to be the number one. So I did my research and I said, okay, who's the number one person out in the world who teaches course creation? And that was Amy Porterfield. So I signed up to Amy Porterfield's course, which is called Digital Course Academy. And that course taught me how to create a successful online course. It also taught me how to market the course. It also taught me how to run the business behind the course. I mean, it was like such a game changer for me. And the thing is when I signed up to that course, I thought, well, I've already created an online course. I just needed to know how to sell it. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was so wrong. I didn't know how to create a course correctly. I had just literally put all my thoughts on paper, and it was boring, and it was long, and it was hard to get through. Like the videos were 45 minutes long, and you know, that we didn't have worksheets, and we didn't have support documents. We had no live element. It was all self-paced. I mean, it was so wrong. It wasn't even funny, but I didn't know it. You don't know what you don't know.
I mean, that comes back to when you went to France, you were open-minded. You wanted to know about other religions, but you just didn't know they were there as such.
Exactly. And in this case, it was like, I took on investors. So I raised 150,000 pounds of investment, which was a huge deal for me. And also actually turns out is a big deal in the female entrepreneur space, because I had all female investors. It was a female-led investment round and a female-led company. And that's just very rare. And we've ended up getting a lot of press out of that because of it. But I took on these investors, and then I had to, Fiona, it was like painful. I can talk about it now because it's there's like open wounds and scars, and this is like a scar, right? I couldn't talk about it at the time. But it was like, I had every month I had to go back to my investors and be like, oh, we missed our enrollment target. We missed our enrollment target. We missed our revenue target. And it was like month after month. In fact, it wasn't even months. It was quarters. I had 6 quarters of losses.
Wow, that's stressful.
And with investment, you know, and we've had a lot of close calls where you're just like, are we going to get out of this? And, you know, and we did every time, but, you know, and that's when I believe that this is a much bigger project than just myself. It took us six quarters of loss to have profitable quarters. And now, you know, now we have solid profitable quarters. But I think it's important to understand that someone has done it before you, and there's no reason whatsoever for you to slog through and try and figure it out on your own. If you want to write a book, you can go and take a course on how to write a book from the people who are the masters at it. You know, if you want to launch a product online, you can go and learn how to launch a product online. I mean, I'm now in the course creation world. I know that anything you want to do, you can go find a course on it, and you should. But here's the next step. You have to invest. And I promise you, the programs that will give you the biggest transformation, they cost the most too. And we have had women email us and say, you know, I didn't know how I was going to do this. So I spent the weekend going through all my expenses, and like, I've canceled, you know, all these memberships, or I had a storage unit. I emptied it out, sold everything in it, and I've used that money to pay for your course. Yeah. So it's not, you know, realistically, if someone wants to do something transformational, it's going to cost money. You have to invest in it. And also, do you know how much money we spend on things like Starbucks? I mean, I don't go to Starbucks. My husband broke that habit in me a long time ago, and there's a really funny story about that. But if you go to a coffee shop every day, there's a great book called The Latte Factor. If you go to a coffee shop every day, you know, for 10 years, you could have given yourself the gift of like 25,000 pounds. It's that simple, you know, and we have habits where we drain money from our account all the time, that if we stopped doing them, we would have the money to do the things that we want to do. And I think, you know, for me, I've had to really, it's been a hard road to get there, but I've really gotten there. And just that side note on my husband. So when we first got married, he said, okay, Joy, here's the deal. I will buy you a coffee machine for your birthday if you stop going to Starbucks. And if you put the money you would have spent at Starbucks into a pot, I will match fund it. And then I'll buy you a coffee machine with it. I was like, wait, hang on. I have to earn my birthday present, first of all, and I have to give up Starbucks coffee.
I love that. That's brilliant.
But I just think it speaks to the fact that, you know, if you're listening to this and you don't feel like you're charging enough, or you're afraid to raise your prices, just remember that people pay for what they value. And if you don't value yourself, doing things for free forever is not valuing yourself and not valuing your expertise and not valuing the things that you've picked up on. If you don't value yourself, then they won't value either. So you have to put a price on something that is the true value of it, even if you're scared, because you know, what's the worst case scenario? No one signs up. What's the best case scenario? People do sign up. People, you know, you sign a new client. And the irony is, Fiona, the more that I lean into that, the more that I realize, do you know what? Mm-hmm. We have the same percentage of people signing up at the higher price that we did at the lower price. Mm-hmm. It's not about the price. It's about what someone thinks this is going to happen in their life by working with you. Is their life going to be better? And are you going to be able to give them a system or a product that gives them real transformation in their life? And if so, money's not the object. They will figure out how to pay for it. And the most important thing too, on the flip side, is to be responsible with that money, you know? And I think, you know, one of the verses in the Bible that I value massively is, well done, good and faithful servant.
It's about helping one another, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, but to that end, and this goes back to that whole point is, you know, what we know about women, and if we're going to talk about women here for a second, what we know about women is, if you give a woman $1 million, right? And you say, you know, like, let's say you give her 500,000 and she turns it into a million, right? And she's got a 500,000 pound profit. If a woman has a 500,000 pound profit, what do they do with it, right? They invest it in schools and in their community. And, you know, they don't blow it on a Lamborghini or a Mercedes or what. I mean, well, Mercedes, bad example, but, and not all men do that either. So I don't want a man like freaking out that, you know, all men do that. Not all men do that. But what I will tell you is that women who are very successful, if you ever have a conversation with someone, Melinda Gates, right? I mean, I have on my computer, I have a sticker with her name on it because one day I want to do humanitarian work with Melinda Gates, right? That's my big hairy audacious goal. I want to work with Melinda Gates, right? Melinda Gates, you know, you give money to Melinda Gates, she will make the world a better place every single time. You give money to Bill Gates, he'll make the world a better place every single time. So, you know, but what we know about women is that they want to make the world a better place. And so if you give a woman a profit, she will reinvest that profit into the community. And that's why so many women are social enterprise leaders, because, you know, I'm in the social enterprise space too. And, you know, we're working on how do we protect a percentage of our profits to, you know, make sure that we are helping women of lower socioeconomic backgrounds get into our program. If I look at the history of Tech Pixies, we've run 21 cohorts. And, you know, and I remember the first 10 cohorts, I gave £27,000 away. And, you know, so if you were to add it up, we've probably given over £150,000 away of scholarships to women who otherwise couldn't afford the program that we run. And, you know, that's being responsible. That is when you get the well done, good and faithful servant. You know, that's when you know you're being responsible with what you've been given. And so to me, I actually think women need to be making more money, because the more money they make, and this, I mean, and I'm really starting to embrace this, the more money they make, the more good they can do in the world. And the more good we can do in the world, I mean, who's not up for that right now?
Yep, absolutely.
You know, and so we need to be leaders in the world, and we need to, you know, invest our profits wisely in making the world a better place. And if you believe in doing that, you know, that will fuel you when you're scared.
Well, I'm inspired. So I'm sure people listening are inspired by that as well, because I'm certainly, that's fired me up, and I'm going to kind of be sitting right.
I'm fired up. I'm ready to go.
So if we now whiz back to you at 15, came back from France, went to the best school in America. And when we met, you mentioned the Olympics as well. So tell me about that.
Well, and it was funny because I wanted to go to the best university in America, and that was actually not possible. They wouldn't let me in.
Which one would you say was the best?
Well, I didn't even bother for Harvard and Yale because the school I came out of, because it was the number one school in America, it was so hard to get into all these other schools. So I went for Brown, and I got rejected from Brown. I got rejected, I think, from George Washington as well, which was a big Georgetown, sorry, not George Washington. So remember, I wanted to be a politician long term.
I didn't know that. Your godfather was a role model, but I didn't realize you wanted to be a politician.
Oh yeah, I wanted to be president of the United States.
So, oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I know, isn't that weird? But anyway, I wanted to go to Georgetown, and I didn't get into Georgetown. I wanted to go to Brown, I didn't get into Brown. So I ended up actually only getting into one school, and I went there, and actually turns out that school was pivotal in it was called Skidmore, and it was one of the seven sister schools. So back in the day when the Ivy Leagues did not have women allowed in them, there were sister schools. So Radcliffe was the sister school to Harvard. Right. And, you know, so I went to Skidmore, which is one of the sister schools. To the Ivy Leagues, basically. So I got into a pretty good school still. And it was an amazing place for the arts. And it was in a really beautiful part of New York, upstate New York. And anyway, I went there, and I told my college advisor that I wanted to be a politician. And he said, well, the one thing politicians don't understand is economics. So I would encourage you to take an economics course. And it turns out I took a government course, and I got my worst grade in college in government. I got a C-. And when I say college, I mean university. It's just they don't get that over it. Yeah. And then I went to and I did the economics course, and I got an A+. So I loved economics. I fell in love with economics, did not love business, was not an entrepreneur, never wanted to run a business, never wanted to be involved in business. I literally wanted to do humanitarian work. I wanted to do, you know, I was speaking different languages. I wanted to possibly do some interpretation work, but then found that was a bit tricky. And I liked economics, but got a little bit bogged down by the numbers. And I just kind of found myself in this place where I like didn't know what I wanted to do, but had a great opportunity to learn. And then I my junior year of university, I decided to go abroad, and I came to London. I went to the London School of Economics, which
I love LSE. I was due to do a TED talk there in March, and I had the rehearsal the week before, and then it got cancelled because of COVID. I love LSE.
Well, and LSE is, as we all know, one of the top universities in the world. So, you know, kind of on this theme of always trying to be the best at what I could be, that was where I ended up. And I loved LSE so much that I never went to a single lecture. No, I ended up falling in love with rowing. And I was already a rower, but I ended up, LSE had a pretty pitiful boat club. There were like two guys and a four-seater boat that was wooden and about 30 years old.
Where was that based?
That was based at the UL Boat Club and in London, in Chiswick.
Oh, okay.
So I turn up to like row for the London School of Economics and find out that that's like not possible. But someone said, well, you can try out for the University of London Women's Boat Club, and which is now actually just ULBC, University of London Boat Club. And so I tried out for ULBC and I made the team. And that was like the team for the whole university. So this is where it gets a little bit creepy because just prior to that was the 2000 Olympics. Some of you who are of a certain age will remember that Steve Redgrave's four won the gold medal in Sydney. And as a 19-year-old and as an aspiring rower, I used to watch the videos of the World Championships before I went to bed at night. And in 1999, I watched the British eight row against the American eight. And afterwards, the Americans had won, but the British had pulled through and had fallen back, but ended up with the silver medal. And afterwards, there was an interview with the American team and the British team. And the American team was very kind of sunglasses on. We're awesome. We're undefeated. We're going to win everything. And, you know, of course, we won today. And it was really, you know, quite frankly, quite cocky. And then they interview the British eight, and this beautiful, handsome, blonde Adonis man says, you know, I'm just so proud of these guys. They pulled themselves together. They worked as a team. You know, I'm just so humbled by how hard they worked. And I'm so thankful to be a part of this group. And the backstory on that was that he was actually asked to be in the eight. He was injured and coming back from an injury. And really where he wanted to be was the four. But he sacrificed the four to help the eight. And the eight ended up getting the silver medal. And that eight went on to win a gold medal in the Sydney Olympics. And my husband ended up going into the four and winning a gold medal with Steve Redgrave. But the part of that story that's crazy is when I was 19 years old, watching this, you know, humble man talk about his success, I said, I'm going to marry that man someday. And, you know, it's just one of those things you say and you don't really mean, but turns out I end up at the University of London Boat Club and we're cleaning a boat and I look up and there he is, like just standing there. And I said to my girlfriend, who's now married to his best friend, I said, is that who I think it is? And she said, yep, it is. And it was Tim Foster. And I just, you know, when I the first day I met him, I ran out of the room crying. I was so starstruck. But, you know, my life was supposed to come to London. It was meant to be. I was supposed to meet him. I was supposed to be.
And then he made you buy your own coffee machine.
Yeah, and he made me buy a coffee machine. I know, but he gave me two beautiful children as well, so you know, I'll forgive him for that.
Well, that's, I mean, it is an amazing story, and it is almost bizarre, isn't it, to think?
It's totally bizarre.
Yeah, but it's fabulous. I love it. It's wonderful. But when you I don't want to move on from that yet, because that's really interesting. So you were rowing anyway, but weren't you doing
archery?
Didn't you do the archery?
Yeah. So, well, we did break up. Tim and I did break up. The romance ended after about 10 months. I moved back to America. He stayed in the UK. 9/11 hit, which was almost impossible to travel after that. And so we broke up. We didn't see each other for 7 years. And in that time, I graduated from university. I got a job in Boston. I was working full time, crunching numbers as a trader. I was an assistant trader.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you majored in economics?
Yeah, I majored in economics. And then what happened was, again, you know, after living in London for a whole year, you come back to kind of, I mean, not that America is bad, but, and I love America, right? So it's, you know, it's, but I never, my heart was, for a long time, my heart was never settled in America. You know, I think that's the thing is, you know, I love America. I grew up in America. It means the world to me. And so many of the positive outlook I have in life and, you know, the go-get-it attitude I've got comes from those American roots. And my faith and everything else comes from those American roots. So I owe a lot to America and I love America. But there was also a part of me that was never fully satisfied there. And I needed to be out in the world. I needed to be a citizen of the world as much as I needed to be an American. And, you know, I'll never give up my American citizenship. I've now got permanent residency in the UK. I can become a British citizen and I will become one. But I'll never give up my American citizenship. I'll never turn that in. It's something I'm very proud of. But I will say there was always a piece of me that felt like I, you know, I was part of a bigger world, not just one country. And so living in the UK was a wonderful part of that. And
London's fantastic for that as well, I think.
Yeah.
London is so multicultural. It really is a melting pot of the world.
Yeah, totally. And I came back and I, you know, just like similar to France, I came back and I was like, I can't do this. You know, I can't just go back to normal because I've just lived abroad. And I've just had this incredible experience, obviously, you know, being with Tim as well. And again, that, you know, the experiences were heightened. You know, I went to Wimbledon, I didn't just go to Wimbledon. I sat in the Queen's box. And, you know, when you, yeah, well, because they've won the gold medal. So, you know, when you win a gold medal with Steve Redgrave, you get to sit wherever you want in Wimbledon. Yeah. But I went to, you know, I went to a premiere, you know, and Stephen Fry sat in front of us. And so again, my world was propelled into this crazy, crazy world. And then I come back to upstate New York and it was like, this isn't going to work for me. So but I was determined not to let my dad's friends help me out. I wanted to make it in my own time, in my own way. You know, I didn't want his help. And so, the irony in that is that I ended up getting a job in Boston and it was my advisor's former student who helped me out. So in the end, I didn't use my dad's connections. I just used my professor's connections.
But it just shows you that connections are connections are connections.
Well, that's what I learned. And so I ended up going and working in Boston. And then, you know, crazy thing happened. There's been a theme here with my dad being a very important part of my life. And when I was 21 and I was about 6 months into that job, he died and it was very sudden.
Sorry.
Well, you know, I talk about it now and it's been such a long time. It's been 18 years that I'm well beyond like the pain of it for, you know, that, but thank you. But he died of what's called pharmacide, which is where you have, he had a heart disease, which was tied into some polio that he had as a young boy, which is interesting because my daughter and I were talking about this the other day because I said, you know, your grandpa John had polio. And she said, well, what's that? And I said, well, it's not dissimilar to the coronavirus. It spread through a camp that he was in when he was a young boy and almost everyone in the camp died, but he survived. And there were long lasting effects of polio on him.
When you say camp, what was...
Like a summer camp. He was like her age at a summer camp and everyone contracted polio.
That's horrendous.
And his whole cabin, I mean, I called my mom to verify it, but you know, his counselor died and many of his friends died. And he somehow survived. And, you know, I wouldn't even be talking to you if he hadn't survived. So I feel so, you know, blessed that I got to live this life because he did survive. But he, so he had long-term heart impacts from polio and he got heart disease. And anyway, long story short, they put him on, he had a heart surgery, open heart surgery. He was on the table way too long, died on the table. They brought him back. But he had some air bubbles that went into his brain and impacted the way he thought about things. And anyway, he ended up having some severe depression following open heart surgery, which happens to a lot of people actually. And they gave him antidepressants and then those had the opposite effect. So this is before they warned you of this, but you can take
mania.
No. So, you can take an antidepressant and it can make you even more depressed.
Okay.
So that happened to him. And anyway, so he took his own life, and that was, you know, very, very difficult for all of us. But now we know that it was tied into the medication, which is, if there's any comfort there, you know, there's no comfort with anyone dying, but there was a small comfort there that,
horrendous. I'm so,
but it made me who I am, you know, and I think that's the point is I then made a decision that I wasn't going to crunch numbers every day and that I was going to do something meaningful with my life, because if my life was going to be over in 40 years, because I was 21 at the time, and I thought, well, if my life's going to end in 40 years and I've already lived a third of it, heck yeah, I got to get out of this job and do something different. And I wanted to go to the Olympics. I that was tied into my always wanting to be the best at something in the world. And I knew I wasn't going to get there as a rower. So I decided to take up archery. I did a whole comprehensive study of all of the different sports in the Olympics and worked out which sports, you know, I could possibly pick up at the age of 24, where there might be gaps in the ability to jump on. And I actually, I did all right. I was sixth in the country in 2004, and I was fifth in the country in 2008.
And that is incredible.
The top three and the top two.
Oh my God. So, I love that.
Yeah. Well, that was a bit manic, but you know, I really found myself in those years. They were hard years, and you know, you chase after a dream that's bigger than yourself, and whether you get the, you accomplish the dream or not, you learn a lot about yourself. Mm-hmm. And what I learned about myself was that I wanted to accomplish something in my life, that accomplishing something was really important. I learned that if you're trying to accomplish something that's bigger than yourself, you need help from something bigger than yourself. So, you know, that's when I went back to my Christian roots. And that's when I went back to my prayer and my Bible and my church and all those good things that really brought light back into my life in what was a very dark period. And, you know, so for me, that was, I mean, it's hard to say, it's hard to think that someone's death can be a blessing in your life, because it doesn't feel like that at the time, and I wouldn't wish it ever on anyone. And if I could bring him back and have him in the room with me again today, I would, but I can't. So, you know, you have to do the best that you've got with what you've got. And fortunately, I had, you know, really strong family around me. My mom was really encouraging. And, you know, when I told her I was going to quit my job to train full time for the Olympics, she's like, she got it. You know, she's like, life's short, go do it. And no one stopped me, you know, and then I just did it. And it was a really formative part of my life. And so fast forward to 2008, where I did not make the Olympic team, but I was ranked fifth in the country, and they took the top two to the Olympics. And I knew I wasn't going to make it. I had a horrific injury in my arm, and I torn a muscle, and I knew I wasn't going to make it. And so I'd applied to work at the Olympics, and I got the job to work there. And then turns out Tim, my husband, was at the Olympics as well. He was the head coach for Swiss rowing. We agreed to go out for a beer. We'd broken up 7 years prior, hadn't spoken to each other or seen each other. And 10 days later we were engaged. So that led a whole nother part of my life, which brought me over to Europe and started me on the entrepreneurial journey that I'm on today.
That is incredible. 10 days after you saw each other. Again, that is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And how long have you been married now?
We're going to hit 12 years in June.
Wow.
No, 11 years in June. 12, and we will have been together 12 in August. So.
Beautiful kids.
And we do have beautiful children. They are. They're adorable. And they're a lot of fun. And, you know, when you said Dina Asher Smith, I was like, yeah, we're big Dina Asher Smith fans in this house, because my son's name is Asher.
Oh, cool. Just fan of her full stuff. I think she's brilliant.
Yeah, she is brilliant. But I think, you know, the thing is that, you know, you do the best with what you're given. And, you know, it definitely helps if you've got people around you encouraging you, for sure. And it helps if you've got a greater purpose than yourself. And when those two factors, you know, combine, it's a very powerful combination. But, you know, at the end of the day, you've also got to believe that you're worthy, that you deserve good things. And, you know, and if you can believe those things, they'll start coming to you. And, you know, and I think that was, you know, that's probably something that, you know, as I've navigated my way through all of these different things, you know, living in other countries and, you know, that journey of what do I really believe in with my faith? And, you know, failed businesses or businesses that weren't going as well as I thought they were going to go. And, you know, I was always seeking. And I think that's the most important thing, is you're always looking for the answer. You're always tapping into, what do I need to do to get to the place that I want to be? And you need to look at that vision, and you need to go into that vision. And like I said, you know, in my morning routine, I've got this brain priming that I do that helps me to really believe that I am worthy, that I deserve success, that I have something to offer to the world. And then I look at my vision, and I look at where I want to be in 3 years and what that's going to look like. And then I spend some time in the Bible, and I spend some time in my devotionals, and I do my own prayer. And you know, and I pray about the women coming through our program. You know, there's tough situations. You know, we've got all sorts of things going on in our community right now. You know, we've had several women come through breast cancer. We've had several women come through loss of parents. We've had women lose children. You name it. There's a woman. We've had women who've come through abuse. You know, we've had everything that can happen to a woman has happened to a woman in Tech Pixies. And, you know, and often I know about it because I see their applications. I read their stories. You know, I know what's going on. And so I spend that time, you know, not just praying that the business will go the right direction or praying that I can, you know, take care of my family, but I, you know, just praying for peace and for healing, for all the different things that women are going through, friends as well. And it's not just about the women in our program, but it's just, you know, your friends, your family, the people that you love. And so I spend a lot of time being grateful for those things as well. And then I do a little bit of yoga, and then I go for my run, and, you know, and then after that, I'm kind of ready to go for the day. And it's made a huge, huge impact in my life. I've now been doing it for almost 3 months. And I, you know, the change in my life in just the last 3 months has been phenomenal.
Really interesting as well, because the guy I was mentioning earlier, the Olympian, he does the same. He has a morning routine. He has a morning ritual where he says that he's grateful, that he, you know, he focuses on what he wants to achieve. And it is really powerful. But the other thing that really strikes me, and the thing that I've written about before, is it's certainly not me that's come up with it. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning.
I love that book.
Absolutely love it. And I often refer to that. But we're all searching for meaning and purpose. And it's difficult because, you know, we can set people off and go and find your purpose. And it's not an easy thing to find. It's something that takes a lifetime to find. And actually, you know, there's evidence that you can become depressed looking for it because you can't find it. But it's this, one of the things is setting yourself the expectation. You won't just find the answer. You have to keep searching. And that's the language you used, is keep searching. And my favorite example that I always use is David Attenborough, because I say, David Attenborough knew what he was passionate about when he was very young. And a lot of people don't. Like you say, you knew what you were passionate about, but you couldn't see what Tech Pixies was going to be. But he said it's the natural world, and it's communicating that to other people. But that's changed and evolved as the world around has changed and evolved, both in terms of what's happening to the environment with plastics, but also what's happening in terms of the technologies to communicate. He's adapted and evolved and changed with that. And that's the thing with purpose. It's having that acceptance that it's never a final destination. It's never concrete. You get perhaps a vision, if you're lucky, of what that looks like. Lucky, and you put work in.
I mean, put work in and the vision will come. I think that.
Yeah, you put the work in, and then it's accepting that it will keep changing, evolving, and there'll be highs and there'll be lows, and there'll be days where you think this just really is a disaster, weeks you think this is a disaster, months you think this is a disaster. It's having that faith, surrounding yourself by the right people. And faith doesn't, I mean, my father, who's also passed away, was very religious, and so I have a sense of faith, but I'm not strongly religious. I have a strong bent towards being humanitarian and all those sorts of things, which resonates when you were saying about that family in France. They weren't religious, but they were humanitarian. And I have a lot of faith in a lot of different elements of different religions. But I think if you do have a faith, then tap into it, you know?
Well, and what you're saying there is so interesting about people kind of searching for it and falling into depression. That is so true. So I think one of the big eye openers for me when I was studying at Exeter, which was the school I went to, was I did a course in existentialism in literature. And we had to read Walker Percy and Nietzsche and all this stuff. And I remember reading these things. And then I remember something very distinctly, which was we would go to the classroom and we'd have this big discussion about the meaning of life. And then one day, the professor who's actually now passed on, he's one of my favorite teachers of all time. But he said, do you know how all of these people died? And none of us knew. And he just went through one existentialist after another, after another, after another, and talked about their deaths. And, you know, one of them died alone in a bath. And one of them died, you know, committed suicide and or killed himself. It's a better way of saying it. But, you know, the point is that many of the existentialists who spent their whole life seeking an answer and never really found it, to be honest, they were quite miserable people at the end of the day. They were quite lonely people at the end of the day. So, you know, in some ways, you almost want to say to someone, you know, pick something and build a foundation around that. And then the rest will come. You know, pick a set of values that are dear to your heart.
Well, the values that absolutely form the anchor and the rock. And that's something you've talked about the whole way through, whether you've been aware of them or not. You know, when you're younger, you don't think these are my values, da, 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 or this is what I adhere to. But those central values, if you can identify those, it gives you such an anchor. And then I think you like pick it. Yeah, pick where you're going. But giving back gives so much meaning as well. There's, you know, there's more and more evidence around being pro-social. And it doesn't mean giving things for free like I do.
You're going to stop that now.
but, you know, in Adam Grant, the Wharton professor, his book, Give and Take, he talks about how actually the most successful people in the world are people who give more. But then there's the givers who get trodden on as well, and it's how you give. But if you're pro-social, and there's an amazing guy, it's a long story, but someone I met last summer on an island I used to go to off Canada when I was 10, child. And so the same people there that when I was growing up, and this guy knew my dad, and my dad, I didn't know he knew my dad. My dad used to send him tea from England.
Oh, so, wow.
And so this guy I met in the capacity of being a psychologist, because he writes the UN happiness report. He's an emeritus economics professor from UBC.
Wow.
And an amazing man, a lovely, lovely man. And then I find out he knows my dad, and like they were coming, and my dad had been to his house for dinner and everything. But he's done all this research, and it's not just him, you know, it's teams of people showing the economic benefits of pro-social behavior. Yeah. And I mean, it comes to your point as well of what you're saying is, giving back is good for yourself. It's good for the other person. It's good for the economy. And actually, in some ways, that's why women are good for the economy, is because their mindset is to give back.
Women are great for the economy, but we've got to get to that place where we believe that we're great for the economy. You know, and you know, to bring this whole conversation full circle, that's why I started Tech Pixies. Because there was a report from PwC that said that if we could get at the time in 2016, there were 426,000 women, according to PwC, that were looking to return to work, but had lost their confidence because they were out of the workplace. And so I wanted to solve that. I wanted to be a player in that game that solves that problem. And, you know, and I thought, well, if we even can tap into a fraction of that market and help a couple thousand women, you know, return to work, change careers, or start a business, we've contributed to the economy. And the thing is they knew 4 years ago that if you could get these women back into work, that the economy would have a huge boost to the economy. And, you know, and I think it's so important for women to really, you know, if they think they've got an idea for a business, and when I say business, I mean, I probably, someone's going to get mad at me for saying this. You know, there's freelancing and then there's running a business. And, you know, and I think the mistake a lot of women make is they freelance when they really should be working for someone else. And because there's so much good you can do for existing companies that are profitable and growing, and you can work your way up, and then, you know, you have these amazing connections to do amazing things. And you just can't get that in the freelance world in the same way. And sometimes you can leave that business world and then become a freelancer and like have them as clients and everything else. But, you know, for a lot of women, I say, if you've taken a career break, the first move back should not be freelancing. You know, the first move back should be finding a company who has the same value set as you, who believes in flexible, part-time, well-paid work, because those jobs exist and you just have to find them. They are hard to find, but they do exist. You know, and if you have in your heart of hearts this desire to set up a company to make the world a better place, or a problem that you want to solve, and you can't find a company that's already doing it that you know that you can't go work for, then go do it. And that's what happened to me. You know, I couldn't find a job that would pay me well to work part-time so I could be at the school run and do all the things that I wanted to do. I mean, all those jobs paid pitifully. And I couldn't find something that gave me the flexibility that I wanted. And also, if you tap back into like that David Attenborough thing, for me, the thing I always knew is I wanted to help people, full stop. Like that, it didn't matter. I got to a place where I was like, okay, my life is dedicated to helping people. Like that is what it came down to. And I was, you know, so I just knew that it didn't matter what I was doing as long as I was helping people. And I found that most jobs that I worked in didn't allow me to help people to a level that I wanted to and with the freedom that I wanted to, which is why I set up a business. And obviously seeing that report and realizing that there was a huge gap in the market to help women get upskilled and return to work, and there were very few players in the field, I thought, let's do it. You know, let's get in there and let's help. And it started with 12 women. You know, it didn't start with 2,000 women. You know, we've now trained over 2,000 women in our free program. We have over 450 women in our paid program. You know, it didn't start like that. It started with 12 women and wanting to help 12 women.
It's fantastic. It really, really is. And it's so important. And it's something that even just intuitively I've always struggled with, is seeing talented women wanting to go back to work and not being able to because of circumstance, confidence, capability of understanding how to do that. And I think what you're doing is absolutely immensely important.
Those companies need women.
It's for women. It's for their kids. It's for the economy as well. I mean, that wasn't when I left it on the economy, that wasn't the place I wanted to leave it, because for me, it's what you're doing for those individuals and their families, because they will feel more self-worth, which means they will be happier, which means they will be better mums if their mums returning to work, and a happier person as a friend, as a daughter, as a whatever they are, a sister, whatever capacity. It's helping them to feel more fulfilled as individuals.
Yeah, and you hit it on the head. Like, I think for me, it's generational, right? So we talked at the very beginning, we talked about my life being surrounded by people who encouraged me, right? But that encouragement is generational. My father's parents did that to him. My mother's parents did that to her. And their parents did it to them. And so this is about changing the generations that come beyond, you know, come after you. And so when we do mindset training in our program, and we help women to really see the power of their brain and to see the power of their mindset and that positive outlook and that kind of growth mindset that you can solve any problem, everything is figure outable, Marie Forleo's famous book. You know, if we can get women to really think that way and see that way, exactly what you just said, their children will be impacted and their children's children. This is not about changing one person's life. It's about changing one person's life and all of the lives that they touch and impact, because that's what really happens. And that's why it's a transformational program. But that's also, you know, that's also why it's so important that we keep doing this work. Everyone who's doing this work to help women find their confidence, find their voice, get themselves out there, it's important work and we need to keep doing it. And I'm so thankful you know, to be able to talk to someone who believes in that too, because the more we can talk about it, the better off we're going to be.
I believe in it so much. I loved meeting you the first time I met you. Straight away, I knew that you were one of those sparky people that I just never want to lose touch with. and it's strange that your investor turns out to be my old boss, one of my favorite bosses. And she's from Colorado, isn't she, as well?
She is from Colorado. And yeah, and I was going to say, she's one of my favorite bosses, too. That's the irony, is that once you take on investors, your investors become your bosses. So, you know, that's another little tip there. If you're raising investment, make sure you pick your bosses wisely. Great tip on that is, like, could you sit in a bus with them for hours on end?
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that. Or be in lockdown with them. That might be an even better time.
Yeah, but I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky. But
well, I don't think it's luck. I mean, I think, as you've said, all these things are about believing and finding and doing, and believing and finding and doing, and that perpetual cycle. And the way you broke it down earlier, I think people find really, really helpful as well. Thank you so much. It's been amazing to talk to you. And I know that lots of people will feel really fired up and inspired. And hopefully there'll be some women out there hungry to get back to work and all those sorts of...
If we've inspired one woman to return to work, change careers, or start a business in order to make the world a better place, we've done our job.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was really great speaking to Joy for this episode. I hope you enjoy listening. If you want to find out more about it,